Hello, I'm Terry Riddle with Parker County Hospital District EMS. We're going to be going over some pre-hospital trauma education based off the BEST EMS 2025 protocols. With me today, I have two of our medical directors. I will let them introduce themselves.
Hey, I'm Dr. Northheim, medical director with BEST EMS and at Parker County Hospital District.
Dr. Skipper Bertrand, one of the other medical directors here with Parker County Hospital District and BEST EMS.
All right, so before we jump into this, y'all want to kind of explain to the audience like how y'all determine what your protocols are going to be?
Yeah, so we have a group of multiple boarded ER physicians that contribute to the protocols, and at the end we have several of our paramedics from our entities that help also contribute. In addition, we have some of the trauma surgeons in our region contribute, and so we do use some of the RAC guidelines as well as some of the most evidence-based trauma recommendations from our partners that we transport to.
And we also have paramedics within BEST EMS that also help us with the protocol review and development.
So first thing, assessment in trauma patients. I think that's one of the key things that we need to do right off the bat. Scene assessment, we put in mechanism of injury in here, not so much for determining where the patient's going to go, but to where we can determine where we're likely to see the injuries, right? You know, airbags going off, massive intrusion. We can probably correlate those to what we're going to see on our patient. Of course, then we move into our rapid trauma assessment where we're addressing any of those life-threatening injuries, our ABCs, spinal immobilization protocols. We're going to talk a little bit deeper about that here in just a little bit. And then we move into our secondary trauma assessment. I think this is kind of maybe one of the areas where we get tripped up or we forget something because we're so focused on those life-threatening injuries.
Yeah, I think just exposing the patient, first of all, make sure we're not missing external bleeding, scalp wounds. You can exsanguinate from scalp wounds, but you know, not missing the midshaft femur fracture, not missing the pelvic fracture, and really examining the front back of the patient thoroughly.
Yeah, so I like to tell our guys they're called trauma shears for a reason. I don't think I've ever brought a massive trauma patient into the ER and the first thing they don't do is cut off every article of clothing and roll the patient. There's no excuse for us not to be doing that in field. Probably going to be the main thing that we're missing, that we're going to be chasing this entire call. Right. And then another thing, which Dr. Northheim here is very, very thorough on beating into our heads, pupils and blood sugar level on every patient.
Yeah, I just think it's important we get really focused on the traumatic event and not what caused the traumatic event. So, you know, bystander information, you know, was this person driving erratically and they crashed? Did someone pull in front of the patient and they crash? What kind of medical history do they have? I mean, were they on narcotics and now they have pinpoint pupils that could be contributing to their altermentation and why they had the accident? Falls, you know, people didn't have lunch, they're working in a construction scene, blood sugar drops, they're on diabetic medications, insulin, so on and so forth. So it's important to try to figure out why the event happened and not leave out your blood sugar and opioids or being an option.
Building off of that is, and one of the things that I know I personally forget a lot is, you know, I have a 65-year-old trauma patient, I'm worried about the injuries, and it's 5, 10, 15 minutes before I'm considering what other medical history do they have. Does that constitute blood thinners? Are they on beta blockers? Could this be affecting what I'm seeing in my patient?
Exactly.
A good tool that we also like to use is shock index. It's very predictive of mortality for these patients, not just in trauma patients. You can use this with your airway management patients, your septic patients. Now, I'm not a math genius, so most of the time I'm not going to be able to tell you 120 over 70 is a shock index of whatever the number is. I just like to always remember if my heart rate is higher than my blood pressure, my shock index is not in the place that I want it to be, right?
Right.
We're not within that normal no shock state.
And I think it's also important. I think when we have patients with head injuries, we get very much focused on the head. You know, we see maybe facial fractures, maybe we see a large hematoma to the head, the patient's altered, we get pushed into that. And then when we get hypotension or a shock index that's abnormal, we really get focused that it's from the head. And just remember that, you know, bad head injuries do not lead to hypotension. They lead to Cushing's triad. So you've got to look elsewhere. So external bleeding, musculoskeletal trauma, pelvic fractures, abdomen and chest are really where you have to focus and just don't get keyed in only on the head.
And then trauma triage. I think this is something that you know, unless you're training on it regularly and actually have experienced it and learned those lessons, like, it's something that we're not winging it when we get there, but we're learning as we go, right? You could do a whole deep dive into trauma triage. That could be a whole nother podcast, but is there anything that y'all want to say, just the important notes from that, that you think people should take away?
Well, one, when you walk up on the scene, one of the first things you can do is just start calling out, hey, anyone that can hear my voice, please walk towards me. And we know those are greens. And so we can then start assessing our more severely injured patients.
Yeah, I think if you say, hey, if you can hear me, can you raise your hand? I mean, that pretty much, you know, probably puts you into the people that can't ambulate but are still mentating, probably the yellows. And then you're left really with the deceased and the reds. And kind of differentiating those are pretty easy. So that's kind of a down and dirty way without sitting there and counting respirations, I think.
I think it brings an important point, too, of communicating with your fellow first responders in these situations. You know, where we're at, we're strictly EMS, and then we have fire departments that handle that aspect of it. Some departments are combined, but training with the people there and having that open communication to make sure everybody knows what's going on is a really important aspect of that.
Yeah, and call for more assets, especially if you're in a rural environment, than you may need, because you can always cancel them. But many times, if you really need, you know, more hands, it's hard to get people there, and time seems to stand still.
So now we start moving into assessing our patients a little bit more, and we all started with the trauma triad of death, but now it's evolved into the trauma diamond of death of hypocalcemia, acidosis, hypothermia, and coagulopathy. If you want to speak on the new role of calcium.
So we all learned the trauma triad of death, and now we really learn that calcium is an integral part of this. So calcium really plays into contractility for the heart, which is obviously important for blood pressure and perfusion. Also pushes into how our blood clots, right? So just recently we've added for all hemorrhagic shock patients to add calcium into that algorithm. Many times in the past when we used packed cells, citrated blood, stuff like that, we felt like the calcium levels were low, and you know, we would think about adding calcium later. But I think the sooner we can get this on board pre-hospital, the better these patients do. So we are now really following the trauma diamond of death and really focusing on warming our patients. We're focusing on coagulopathy. All of these are going to play together. But adding that calcium piece, I think, is something that we've just added in the last year and a half.
Yeah, I think some of the newest research shows that, especially in the presence of hemorrhagic shock, 80 to 90% of the patients in the ER are hypocalcemic upon arrival. Right. And then breaking down the original triad, we have coagulopathy, right? The body's ability to form clots. So in trauma, it's present in nearly 1 in 4 severely injured patients. And in those patients, there's a 4-fold increase in mortality.
Yeah, so, and contributing to this is, you know, we have these patients getting sometimes a lot of fluid, too much fluid, and that just gives us that Kool-Aid looking bud, that dilutional coagulopathy. We have the calcium depletion. And then just remember that, especially if you have a patient over the age of 65, it seems like nowadays there's a good chance they're going to be on some type of anticoagulant, whether it's a NOAC like Eliquis or Xarelto, or even just aspirin or dual antiplatelet therapy, possibly aspirin and clopidogrel. So, and then once you get down that pathway of severe coagulopathy and get into DIC, we're really behind the eight ball at this point, and these patients really need whole blood, which is the optimum resuscitation modality that we like to use, and thankfully we are carrying whole blood here.
Yeah, I think we've seen a lot of positive outcomes with administration of whole blood, not just in our trauma patients, but in a lot of our medical patients too. And we have acidosis, right? We know our normal body pH is 7.35 to 7.45, but when we're in a hypovolemic state, we're in hemorrhagic shock, we're cold, our pH is going to start trending downward, right? And so with this, we have a big problem, because as we get more acidic, our body's ability to clot gets worse, which is now compounding our coagulopathy when we've already used up those clotting factors or we've bled them out. And then it's important to understand that acidosis is a direct consequence of tissue hypoxia,
right,
with these patients. we're normally in an aerobic metabolism. We start switching to an anaerobic metabolism. We start getting a greater buildup of acid, which then again affects our coagulopathy even more. So what are some ways for y'all that we can try to manage in some of these hemorrhagic shock patients, their pH?
Well, I think number one, keeping them warm. We should be in a warm environment in the back of the truck or in the ER, especially. We should be, if we're not sweating, it's probably not a warm enough environment. So once we cut the clothes off, getting these people adequately covered. I think the other part that we kind of miss is that as the pH changes, it really starts to push the oxygen dissociation curve. So you start to have issues with, you know, oxygenation and perfusion and stuff like that. So I think keeping them warm, and then obviously we'll talk about TXA in a little while, but once the clot is formed, to stop your body from breaking down the clot's important. But a lot of these patients, like Dr. Bertrand said, already have a coagulopathy because they're taking medications that cause that, and so we're really behind the eight ball with those patients initially.
Yeah, and then that leads us into hypothermia, which I think is one of those things that we disregard. We like to tell all of our guys here, if you have a trauma patient that's bleeding out in the back of the ambulance, you should be sweating,
right?
Crank that heat up, warm blankets, warm fluids, warm blood preferably. But we do know that hypothermic patients, so defined as a 95 degrees Fahrenheit or less, have a mortality rate of 13.5% as compared to a normothermic trauma patient with a 2.3 in the presence of hemorrhagic shock. So simple basic skills, we're buying a lot of survivability.
Yeah, just keep in mind, even though you cover the patient and you go to reach for your LR or NS off the shelf in an ambulance that's 72 degrees, 74 degrees, maybe even 80 degrees, you're still giving the patient cool fluids, right? So having at least a warming bag for your fluids, if not having Quinflow or something that you use to give blood, is really the optimal way to do it, to really get the temperature of that fluid up so that you're helping them with the with their issue with being cold.
That's what I think the diamond explains everything so well, because as we affect one point on it, we are getting positive effects on the other three points, right? But if we don't address one of them, we're just going to get worse.
All right,
so let's move into medications, some medications and fluids we give in trauma patients. I'll let y'all talk about the whole blood, which y'all got for us out here.
Yeah, I think whole blood's a game changer. We worked with our trauma partners to develop this program. I think the hardest part we had was to try to get it from the blood banks and really start that program, because it really wasn't an EMS program when we started. But we've had multiple patients, both medically and traumatically, that have done really well with whole blood. It really replaces your clotting factors. We're using a lot less fluid. And this is kind of just the protocol we came up with. We're using it for all ages, and we have a little bit different vitals for our older patients over 65 years old, but really these vitals are matching what our TXA is, so it's easier for folks to remember. But like TJ said, with acidosis, if the capno is less than 25, that's really going down that metabolic acidosis route that decreased perfusion, and so that's one more of our criteria besides age and vitals.
I think it's great that we have capno in there, because it's a breath-by-breath reading, and we can monitor how our treatments are affecting the patient and what we need to do and how we need to act without having to wait on a manual blood pressure. I specifically said manual blood pressures. I know y'all are very passionate about that. Anytime we're doing anything that is affecting perfusion, manual blood pressures.
Absolutely. All your sick patients, medically or traumatically, should be getting manual pressures, at least initially. And especially if you don't believe the vitals, the patient's altered, something's not making sense, they need a manual pressure. Because many of these automated pressures will be off by, you know, 20, 30, 40 points, which makes a big difference.
So then we move into TXA. That's become fairly popular throughout all EMS. I think everybody's using it. We've recently changed to 2 grams from 1 gram IV push. Same protocol as the blood. And we also use it for OB bleeding.
Yeah, and it's become so popular because it's so effective, right? And it seems like, again, like say, all of these patients over 65 you see or so are on some kind of anticoagulant therapy. And even just using it for, not necessarily for trauma, but for, let's say, epistaxis, has been a game changer. We rarely have to pack any nasal cavities anymore, because of epistaxis, now that we have TXA available. We also have it indicated for OB hemorrhage at the 1 gram level, and we also see often our OB partners putting patients on TXA outpatient when we encounter them with early bleeding.
Yeah, it's kind of the Swiss Army knife. Also with, when you think about angioedema, we started putting in for hereditary and ACE inhibitor angioedema. So it's kind of the Swiss Army knife that, that really helps us on multiple fronts with, we have it for nebulized bleeding, for post-tonsillar bleeding, where you can give it that route. We have intranasal, wound packing wise, and IV intranasal, IV and IO. So it's really a drug that serves multiple purposes in our protocols.
Yeah, and like Dr. Northheim said earlier, I think it's important to note that it actually preserves blood clots from breakdown. It's not forming new blood clots. You could get into the whole science of it, but I like to keep it super simple. I'm just a paramedic, so that's the easiest way for me to remember it.
It's really the opposite of TPA, so if you can kind of keep that in your mind down the coagulation pathway. It really works the opposite of TPA. So TPA breaks down the clots, where TXA is going to help the clots from being broken down by the body.
So most of this data, I believe, is based off the CRASH II and the women's trials, which basically came to find out that the chance of surviving any cause of death was 1.72 times higher in those who received TXA compared to those who received a placebo. So if we're starting to warm these patients, we're starting to reperfuse these patients, we're giving them the TXA, we're giving them the calcium, we're stacking up a lot of wins on our side, especially in the pre-hospital environment, right? This wasn't normal treatment 5 years ago.
Right.
And we often get the question, why the three-hour time limit? Well, because there's been no improvement in survival when they look at these people who receive it after 3 hours of the injury. And hence why it does not seem to affect anyone with a GI bleed, because most of the time those bleeds are starting several hours before you have any evidence of the bleeding. And certainly it seems before people are calling us to assist them.
Right.
So I will ask you a question. We have whole blood here. We also have TXA. I only have one vascular side or an IO. What do I give first, the blood or the TXA?
No, I mean, we're going to do blood first. We're going to fill the tank first, support the patient's blood pressure, and then TXA and calcium, I think, after that. I think that should be the push.
Yeah, we've already talked in depth about calcium here. And so now we're talking about our isotonic fluids, which our department's different. I know there's some departments out there that are just shooting for a target blood pressure regardless of the amount of isotonic fluids, whether it's LR, NS, they are given. We don't want to speak about why we probably shouldn't be doing that.
Well, I think it depends almost solely on whether or not you're carrying blood. I mean, if you have blood and you have a hypotensive trauma patient or a medical patient that's losing blood in some sort of fashion, blood's got to be your number one. Unfortunately, not everybody has blood, and so they're having to give fluids to fill the tank, and you know, you can't really put an amount on it because hypotension is very dangerous for these folks, especially with head injuries, very dangerous for perfusing their vital organs. But we luckily have multiple units of whole blood out here in the county, so that should be our first one that we're heading towards. I kind of look at, you know, if you do have fluids, there's been some studies that kind of show if the pressure is not changing after 500 cc, you probably should be start looking for some pressors. But in addition, if it's something that the tank is empty and your patient's bleeding or your patient's septic, you still have to kind of continue those fluids, but maybe a little earlier pressor involvement may help those patients.
Certainly you want to consider the pressors if you have someone that you're trying to get to a resuscitative state to where you could go ahead and proceed with that intubation. That would be a good indication to give them a low push dose pressor.
And we've mentioned it several times, but I think it's important to mention here again with the fluids that if we have the ability, we're given warm fluids,
yeah,
right?
Absolutely.
You talked a lot about how you're pulling a 72 degree normal saline out. A blanket's not going to work, right? And then just one thing I like to illustrate and learn this from the guys over at Foam Frat, and I've seen it done, wrapping the hot pack around fluid tubing in order to try to get warmer fluid to them. If you watch their study, they did a quick study where they placed two blankets down, multiple hot packs, ran the tubing back and forth, more blankets, and then dripped it, I think, at like 1,000 an hour or something. It started at, let's say, 72.0 degrees. It came out at 72.1 degrees. So really, you're just wasting that hot pack when you could be putting it in the groin, on the neck, wherever you have the ability, depending on where their injury is.
Right.
All right, so y'all already started kind of talking about pressors in trauma. I think we're a little bit more aggressive here than most places. There has been some associations with higher survivability rate, assuming you're filling the tank and using those pressors a little more aggressively. Most people carry epi or norepinephrine. What do y'all prefer and why?
Well, I think our go-to in the ER is what we try to really push out to pre-hospital is norepi, is levofed. Really, you're going to get the clamp. You're going to not get the increase in heart rate, but you're going to get a clamp to increase blood pressure. So I think post-ROSC, we're showing that. Certainly, if you need a couple bumps and trauma while we're filling the tank and while we're stopping bleeding, that's important. Epi will give you an increased heart rate. I think, you know, especially post-ROSC, you're a little worried about that a little bit, adding something that may cause more dysrhythmias to the picture, adding more heart rate to people that are already having a hard time with their ventilation and perfusion. And then I think, you know, epi should be considered for those patients that are bradycardic and hypotensive. In addition, probably your anaphylactic shock type patients where that epi is probably going to help that process. But I think most everything else, we're pretty much going to levofed, you know, push dose and drip after that.
Yep.
And I think going back to our first slide, right, like we need to rule out all the other causes for this hypotension, right? So not only do we assess the patient at first, we need to be constantly reassessing, especially if we're pulling the trigger on pressors. Yeah. You know, do they have a tension pneumo? Did we miss some uncontrolled hemorrhage somewhere? Antibiotics, open fractures, fairly new to us here. We use it in septic patients, but using it for an open fracture, I'm going to let y'all speak on that because y'all administer a lot more antibiotics than I ever will.
Well, it's really considered standard of care in the hospital to start these within 60 minutes, and it's one of the parameters that the American College of Surgeons will grade hospitals' trauma centers on. And so we were noticing that there's often a delay in getting these to patients in the hospital, and this is just another one of those things that we can start in the field. Get it started. It's better for the patient by far to get it started early. And a lot of times there's a question, you know, if the patient just has a little abrasion. Well, remember that that little abrasion could have just been a bone. It could look like an abrasion, but it could have been where the bone popped out the skin and then retracted back in. So you're more likely to not cause them any harm by giving them the cefepime than if you withhold it and they end up not getting the antibiotic for 2, 3, 4 hours.
Yeah, and again, the reason for cefepime, I think mostly in the ED, we'd probably give a couple grams of ANSEF, but since we're carrying cefepime on the sepsis side, you know, started carrying two different antibiotics, and we decided to do that. So we probably will push that out to under 15 as well, probably next protocols, but we did start kind of our trauma age to start that.
Yeah. Oh, that's pretty much most of the major medications that we use for trauma patients, more specifically hemorrhagic shock. So let's start breaking down some of the specific injuries that we're going to see. And I think the number one is head injury, right? Like, assume everybody has an head injury until it can be ruled out.
Yeah, we used to kind of focus on, you know, permissive hypotension for every trauma patient, get them to 90. And I think what some of the studies showed and, you know, some of our trauma colleagues really kind of pushed us to increase that to about 110. Especially if they have a bad head with it. So that's our goal now is 110 if it's a trauma patient plus a head. I think that the argument still with a penetrating traumatic injury is probably permissive hypotension and 90. But that's why we changed it the last time around.
So we have our classic Cushing's triad, you know, widening pulse pressure, bradycardia, irregular respirations. We want to sit these people up, improve venous drainage. And I think it's important, especially when we move over into some of the management of these head injury patients with regards to capno, that we are delineating the different types of head injuries, right? I don't know if y'all want to speak on that. I know that it varies anywhere from 30 to 35 to leave them at 40, and there should be specific targets for specific patients.
Yeah, I think this data has been kind of all over the place. We used to kind of shoot down in the 30 range, but I think keeping a physiologic 35, 45 is probably the safest. I would say if they're showing any signs of herniation, such as Cushing's or posturing or blown pupils, that we should probably keep them down towards the 35 range. I think that's what everyone's really recommending at this point, and that's what we're doing as well. Obviously, preventing hypoxia is a big thing, and preventing hypotension is another big piece in these head injury patients.
Yeah, because if we take this head injury patient that maybe is just a minor head injury, concussion, they have other injuries, and we start driving them down to 30, well, the whole point is cerebral vasoconstriction. So now you have this normal brain that's not getting the oxygen and the nutrients it needs, and those people have significantly worse outcomes. So again, going back to the assessment portion, assessing these patients thoroughly before you start making treatment decisions, I think is of the utmost importance, especially in multi-system trauma patients. And then the one everybody, I think, trains on a whole bunch of times, the tension pneumothorax. I think it's probably one of the things, besides maybe airway, that we train more on than we actually ever will do in our career. I think we all know the classic signs. I don't know if there's anything specific you want to say about tension pneumothorax, when you pull that trigger.
Well, I've seen people come in saying, you know, in the back of the truck, it's hard to hear. Some people don't have the best of stethoscopes, but I didn't really hear anything on the left, and he was having chest pain. And meanwhile, the patient's not on supplemental oxygen. The patient's hypertensive at 170, and we have crews, you know, throughout the systems that, you know, we've dealt with or other systems that transport to the hospital that go ahead and dart these patients. Well, the important part is it has to be a tension pneumothorax. Most of these patients that we see from a trauma standpoint have pulmonary contusions. They have small tension. They have small pneumos. Most of these do not have tension pneumos. So I think it's important to make sure that these patients are, you know, you're having a hypoxic event. Maybe they're on higher flow O's. You can't hear lung sounds. Maybe they're hypotensive. They're tachycardic, but they should really be a tension pneumo, because if you go ahead and dart people that don't have a pneumo and you're wrong, right, just because they're pulmonary contusion or they're splinting, some broken ribs, you essentially could give them a pneumothorax. And I think the other thing we've seen too is just be very careful. We're using, for the most part, we're going lateral is our recommendation, fourth intercostal, fourth and fifth. But especially when we're on the heart side, I mean, we're putting 3 1/4 inch needles for the most part. Some agencies have gone from 14 to 10 gauge. If there's not a space of a pneumothorax or a tension pneumo, you're immediately going to poke into the lung, which can cause bleeding. In addition, you're pretty darn close to going to the ventricle. So it should be much like a peripheral IV. We don't stick the entire needle into someone's arm. You know, we go and we get a flash, we advance the catheter. And the catheter is safe to advance. It's just not safe to advance a 3 1/4 inch needle, especially if we're using it on kids, elderly folks, smaller folks. So I think those are the big things.
Yeah, and also, like we mentioned, especially when you're either outside or in the back of the ambulance, it's really difficult to, you don't have a quiet environment there. So it's really difficult to get good auscultation of the lungs, right? So this is where ultrasound is going to come into play also, because the sensitivity of ultrasound for detecting pneumothorax is so much higher than our auscultation. And again, though, if we detect a pneumothorax in ultrasound, unless they have the definition of tension, it doesn't need to be treated. Right. It could just be a small pneumothorax that'll resolve on its own. And, you know, along those lines, if you feel like you got a tension pneumothorax, but your dart occludes with blood, then you may need to do that several times. And depending on the severity of the patient's injuries, you could consider finger thoracostomy at that point to relieve a tension hemothorax.
And I think routinely we receive patients in the ER where they say, yeah, I thought through my H's and T's and it's a trauma rest, a blunt trauma rest, penetrating trauma rest to the chest. And yet no one has, you know, done bilateral needles on that patient. I really think that, you know, we call 3-hole punch within what we do in the ED, where patients get at least 2 needles or 2 finger thoracostomies before we call them pericardial, or we're looking at ultrasound to make sure they have a tamponade. But you're not really ruling out your T of tension pneumo unless on your blunt trauma and penetrating trauma, you're actually sticking either bilateral needles, bilateral finger thoracostomies. You're not really ruling that out, because I think with somebody bagging, it is very difficult to tell whether or not they have good lung sounds. So that's another thing we see in the ED and kind of come in contact with in the field.
All right, so now we move on to spinal injuries. I don't really have much to say about this. I'm never going to be able to tell you, you know, this patient's left forearm's numb, so it's C6. The way we educate here is, you cannot rule out a spinal injury, so do your protocol, which here, C-collar, very, very, very rare that we would actually do the full packaging effort, if at all. But I think it is important to note that, like, there is no way for a responder in the pre-hospital environment to rule out a spinal injury.
Right.
And I think Dr. Northam will agree with this, most of the cervical spine fractures that we find on our workup in the ER are not suspected because the patient's unable to give us an adequate history for the, you know, if they're severely injured. And so a lot of them we find it's like, you know, oh wow, they have a C5 pars fracture also.
Yeah, I think the important thing is too, is we used to board all these patients, and as soon as you guys get to the ER, we'd have to take them off within 20 minutes. That was kind of the rule. Well, we still didn't have imaging on that patient, right? So we'd essentially be moving over a patient with a collar holding C-spine, moving over to our bed and taking the taking the board off without knowing if we had a spinal fracture. So do a good, you know, motor sensory type exam, make sure they can move everything. That's an important piece, because if they can't, that'll fall into different trauma criteria depending on your hospital. I think that's something important that we should do in our exam, but certainly can't rule it out.
And then burns. I really love the way Best EMS protocol is set up, because you simplified the fluid administration, right? There's so much time that Parkland burn formula, the guys that do critical care, you know, they get those questions on the FBC of how much are you going to give in the first 3 hours? We don't really need to be doing that, do we?
No. I think that a lot of the fluids have changed, just like in trauma. I mean, we had a pretty big burn lecture from one of the burn centers probably about 6 or 8 months ago, and she really, really, really pushed how we can really overload these patients with fluids. But, I mean, I'll be honest, if you had a really bad burn, say you had a 40, 50% burn, I think all of us would feel like we should give that patient a liter of fluid, and now it's very limited. You know, 14 and older, yeah, we're given 500 ml. The other piece is, too, is don't get focused into the burn. I mean, if you have a multi-system trauma patient, an MBC, that the car catches on fire and they have burns, you know, if your closest trauma facility, level one, level two, and you need to stabilize that patient, I mean, we can worry about the burns later. They can get, you know, debridement later. They can get more fluids, and the hospital can take that over. But just don't get tunnel vision in the burn. Don't miss the other injuries that that patient potentially could have.
And kind of going into that, with regards to level one and level two trauma centers, I often get the question, we brought them here, but should we have gone to level one trauma center? Well, just realize that the only difference between level one and level two is that a level one has a research department. So level twos can handle just about every trauma that a level one can. So don't worry, if you have a severely injured patient, level one or level two is your place to go.
All right, and then we move into crush injuries. I'm going to let y'all speak a little bit more about this. This is a fairly new protocol for us, but I think especially in the area we live in where we have all this huge construction going on, it's very important to have this tool handy available if we need it. But I'll let y'all speak more on the actual treatment process.
Well, one of the first things we want to talk about, though, is when we talk about crush injuries, we're talking about someone who's got an entrapped limb and for some significant period of time. So just having a traumatic injury where your forearm or your lower leg was crushed is probably not going to lead you to any kind of significant injury with regard to what we're worried about here with hyperkalemia and such. But if you have that piece of farm implement equipment trapped on a patient's thigh for 30, 45 minutes, prolonged extrication in an MVC, then they certainly have the potential to have development of some hyperkalemia from release of all the potassium in that muscle tissue. And so that's where we came up with this protocol for administering sodium bicarb and continuing fluids after the initial fluid bolus.
I mean, you're diluting the muscle enzyme, the CK, out. You're pre-treating with fluids, trying to protect the kidneys, because that's at the end of the day, that's what's happening, is you're having a kidney issue from the rhabdo, from the elevated CK, and then obviously very carefully monitoring your four lead ECG as the part is being taken off the patient, and if they're starting to look like a hyper K, start treating it, right, and go slow with that process. So I think we just covered that pretty in depth in our med spec class for task force. That's something you think about with, you know, parking garage collapses. Surfside had quite a few of those. 9/11 did as well, but how to kind of prep for that.
I think this also illustrates the point for good communication on these scenes, right? Especially if you have split departments like we have out here. You know, my role is medical treatment, fire's role is rescue, but those two need to combine, right? Because we need to start treating these patients while they're out, not just in crush injuries, right? Airway issues, they're trapped in the car. Just can't highlight how important it is to have those good working relationships, right, and speak up, right? Don't let somebody spend 15 minutes getting somebody out of a car that's not breathing. I put this in here basically for our guys because we have such long transport times and we have a level three center, but this was actually updated to the ATLS and inserted, and it just states that compared with patients with unilateral femur fractures, patients with bilateral femur fractures are at a higher risk for significant blood loss, severe associated injuries, and pulmonary complications, multiple organ failure, and death. Is there anything y'all want to say specifically about that? I'm more targeting our crews here.
I mean, femurs are strong bones, and you break one, it's a lot of mechanism and force. You break two, it's a lot. I think it's very similar to, you know, if you have calcaneal fractures from a fall, you got to look up the spine for to make sure you don't have a spinal fracture. So just high velocity, high energy, lots of force.
And just be, you know, aware and suspicious of them, especially in your patients that are intubated. Because if it's a high mechanism injury where you have a patient that requires intubation, there's, you know, good chance they could have at least one or maybe two femur fractures that are occult.
And also make sure in these patients you don't have a significant pelvic fracture before you start putting traction splints on them, because you definitely can make things a bit worse. So
drownings, we're going to warm the patient. Spinal immobilization, we have no idea what happened when they went under that water. We're in Texas, so we don't get any of that really, really cold water around here, except for maybe one day a year. So for our protocol, if you're submerged greater than 1 hour, we're done, regardless of the temperature. Certainly positive pressure ventilation on these patients. And then if y'all would like to explain the reasoning for the ACLS drugs and the temperature and the defibrillations.
Yeah, I mean, they just really don't work. I mean, ACLS said that, so we really got to warm these patients before they end up working. So if you shock three times and it doesn't work, we're going to continue to warm these patients up. You want to talk about secondary drowning?
Well, this phenomenon of secondary drowning we're going to address in the next protocol revision. Really, it's highly unlikely that if you have a patient who is not symptomatic at the time of injury, that they'll become symptomatic hours later. So a lot of these, and this really pertains to us a lot in the ER, a lot of these people that we tend to want to keep and watch for 3, 4, 5 hours, we don't really need to. If they're asymptomatic, we can let them go without any worries.
Yeah, I think this is another time where if you have those fluid warmers, right? Because I wouldn't naturally just think to start putting a fluid warmer on a drowning patient, because they don't feel cold, especially here in Texas. But you have to realize that that water temperature is not 98.6 degrees Fahrenheit, right? And the fluids we're giving them certainly aren't. Amputations, I don't think there's a whole bunch to talk about here. I think one of the big points to highlight is we don't want to put the affected part right on top of ice, right? We want to separate that. And then whatever else y'all would like to say about these specifically?
Well, one is that we don't really need to get tied up at the scene too much and where we should bring these patients. Most trauma centers can assess these and then determine if they are a candidate for re-implantation or not. Surprisingly, very few of these injuries are. And so really, if you have anything, any amputation past the PIP joints, those are not eligible for re-implantation. So, but if you have any questions, just, you know, your level 1, 2, or even 3 trauma center can assess them and then transfer if needed.
Yeah, we've got a really great diagram that we had hand surgery from multiple places kind of help us with. And, you know, really the big things are the really big proximal. I mean, if you lose, you know, at the wrist or the mid hand, or sometimes if you get a proximal thumb, it can be an issue. But I would say that, you know, we don't need to belabor that, because it seems like on a monthly basis, one place is in re-implantation and then it changes to somewhere else and we end up going miles and miles and get disappointed that they don't have it. So I would say most of these can be handled at a place with, you know, generally ER or hand coverage.
Yes.
So that sums up some of the injuries we're going to see. We certainly don't have time to cover every possible traumatic injury. But one of the things I think that we're real progressive with is our traumatic arrest protocol. I think more people are catching up to us than us catching up to people. So traumatic arrest when we're here, pulseless, apneic, they're in a systole, we're done.
Correct. Zero chance of survival.
So important to note that we have to determine that they're in a systole, right? So they need pads on, even if they're smashed in that car, unless it's obvious. So a couple of things that we have that delineate in our protocol and the type of whether we work it as a trauma arrest or a medical arrest. So we have hangings, drownings, electrocutions, and asphyxiations. Are we treating those as medical or trauma?
It's all medical. I mean, they're all basically from, you know, hypoxia and some sort of asphyxiation. Electrocutions as well. It's not really traumatic unless they got electrocuted and then fell a significant amount of feet. We do have some of those cases too, so it's important. You know, every case is different.
Well, I'm a big fan of reference guides, and we carry those in our monitors that have all this information in it, because hanging was the first one or the one to me that took the most time getting over that that's a medical arrest, just because you can see the trauma right there, and it just, your mind just wants to go to that. So I can't stress how important it is to have a reference document. We carry these in all of our monitors. I believe all of Best EMS does too.
Yeah, so if anybody listening here isn't Best EMS and would like those, just please contact us, and we're happy to share that. We have people throughout the country that have checklists that they've used some of our stuff, they've incorporated their own, they've added other things. We have some that have some of the pediatric dosing on them. So happy to share those. But I think in a very high acuity situation, but really, you know, things that don't happen as often for us, that they're really great to pull out and reference. They're really great, especially if you have somebody on scene that may be disagreeing with what we're doing, like, oh gosh, we have to do CPR on this trauma patient. You can hand it to them and say, hey, can you please read this to me? So everyone gets on the same page and really does the best thing for the patient and keeps our crews safe.
And one that we don't have on this list, but to consider, is snake bites, right? We always have that fall into the trauma realm. But in actuality nowadays, that is a medical disease, because it's pretty rare that a snake bite victim actually needs a surgeon. They need Crofab. If they get to that point, then they need Crofab. But mostly they just need monitoring and then determination if they need any treatment beyond just monitoring.
A lot of them are dry bites, so sometimes we just kind of sit there and watch them and get labs, and they don't need anything more definitive.
Then we have our traumatic arrest with any rhythm but a systole, right? So we're going to approach each of these patients differently depending on what caused them to go on arrest. So blunt traumatic arrest, what are we doing?
So we're looking to control our hemorrhage, right? Because the most common cause is going to be exsanguination, whether you can see it externally at the scene or whether they have internal hemorrhage either within their chest or abdomen. That's the main thing that needs to be addressed initially. We need to address their airway and get their volume resuscitated, and hopefully we have blood available to do that. But if it's an arrest case, then we want to go to our procedures, right?
Yeah, so I mean, pericardial syntesis, if you have ultrasound, you can tell there's not a tamponade, there's not a reason to do one. Either bilateral needle decompressions or frequent thoracostomies, but really, You are treating your H's and T's, but just don't kind of think about them. Actually, in this case, we're treating them. And I think that a really good thing to think about is that our medical arrests, we only move about 10 to 30% of the patient's blood around doing CPR. These patients are hypovolemic, right? So they don't have blood that we're moving around. So if I'm doing compressions and TJ is trying to do pericardial syntesis or they're trying to do finger thoracostomies, I'm kind of in the way. And at the end of the day, I'm not really circulating anything. So that's a big push. It's been a massive culture change in our region and for our agency not to jump on the chest. And then obviously ACLS drugs are not recommended in these cases. This is not an ACLS problem. This is not a 65-year-old hypertensive hyperlipidemic patient. This is a hypovolemic trauma patient. Now, sometimes you get there and there's no damage to the car, there's no damage to the person. Maybe they had a medical arrest. We're going to have to kind of sift through some of those details. But basically, after we do all of these things, which typically takes 8 to 10 minutes, if we don't have a pulse back, we can call it. So we're not driving code to the hospital with someone who has 0% chance of surviving.
And we talked about our cards. This is a good time where we have, you could pull out the checklist card and have someone who's not actively engaged in the resuscitation of the patient to go over the checklist and call out things and say, you know, have we done that? Have we done finger thoracostomies? Have we done pericardial syntesis? Do we have ROSC yet? And just go down that checklist to make sure we don't miss anything and to make sure we're not doing too much unnecessary things.
Yeah, I think the biggest thing for us to overcome when we first started doing this is we had, you know, volunteers or PD or somebody that maybe not trained in the best EMS way or not expected to be, but we show up on scene and they're doing chest compressions and we're like, y'all need to stop. Yeah, just need to stop. And it's a big culture change.
I think. Understand, it's difficult. You have a patient who's arrested and you feel like you want to get in there and do compressions because it's so ingrained in us to do that.
Well, the other important part is too, if you have an FRO that may not carry a cardiac monitor and only carries an AED, then they really can't stick pads on or leads on to determine asystole, right? So having a monitor where they could actually do that is very beneficial, especially if your transporting entity or your medics are 10 to 15 minutes out. It's a really uncomfortable scene to be on with a patient that you don't think needs to be worked, but you can't verify death.
So. Yeah.
Yeah, and then we have blunt versus penetrating body trauma arrest. The only difference here is early transport. And y'all want to explain why that would be?
Well, just much higher chance of we, with the penetrating to the chest or belly, we know where the injury's at. We can hopefully get some hemostasis on it. We hopefully can, you know, get chest tubes, clamshell, thoracotomy, stuff like that. So those patients have typically a higher chance of surviving than your blunts. Blunts, you're not really sure what's causing the problem.
And then penetrating trauma to the head.
So just remember, like Dr. Northheim said earlier, you're not going to get hypotensive and bleed out from a head injury alone. So always consider that if you do see a bad head injury, that they still could have something else going on in their chest or abdomen. You do want to get the, if they do have some bleeding going on, get that bleeding under control with pressure, dressing or gauze or whatever you need to do. The big thing is managing the airway, and chest compressions we feel are okay in these. And the, and our big thing with this is, if we can't save this patient, we might be able to save many more, right, with organ donation. So just remember that, you know, that's always a possibility.
Yeah, we don't follow the fact that brain matter is obvious sign of death anymore. I remember when I was on the box, we followed that, and we've had several patients with brain matter that from a cardiac etiology, we've gotten them back, cardiac perspective, we've gotten them back, and they've donated multiple organs to folks. So I think that's important to think. You may think this patient's not going to make it, and they may not, but if you could get cardiac activity back and you could, you know, potentially this patient's a donor, you could really impact a lot of people's lives.
All right, so we're going to move on to airway management and trauma. For those of you watching this, there's a picture of a salad there for a reason, and that is the salad technique. Dr. Ducanto developed it. He also developed the Ducanto suction device. Suction. We teach a lot of airway here. We always teach to lead with suction, but in a trauma patient, until you open that mouth up and get down there, you do not know what yours going to be in the way of your view. So suction is the best thing that you can do to prep yourself for success in this.
Yeah, I would say any airway, just assume there's something in the airway. And I think the challenge for us now is, you know, video laryngoscopes are amazing, but as soon as you dunk them in some sort of blood or fluid in the back of the airway, I mean, it's very tough to get them cleaned out. Very different than the DL days that, you know, you could dunk it in there and all you're losing is maybe a little bit of your light, but you're not losing the visibility. So I would always lead with suction. As Chris Muscle always says, it's your windshield wiper in front of your window. So always lead with your windshield wiper.
And just leave it in.
Leave it in.
Leave it in. So some of the our concerns when we're talking about these trauma patients, especially in the presence of hemorrhagic shock, when we're going to manage their airway, is our SpO2, certainly, right? SpO2 only tells us the amount of hemoglobin that's saturated with oxygen. It doesn't tell us how much hemoglobin we have, so we have to be aware that these patients could rapidly desaturate during the attempt. And of course, we all know that as we start having episodes of hypoxia, worse and worse outcomes. Our blood pressure. I'd like to tie this in with CO2. Two things that you need to be monitoring and making sure that you're optimizing this patient the best you can, even if you are keeping them in a permissive hypotension before you start slamming drugs. And then also to be cognizant of the effects that our medications can have on this patient, right? Certainly would prefer to use ketamine than fentanyl on a hemorrhagic shock patient, depending on what your protocols are. If your protocol saver said, please don't use it. We already stressed the importance of the manual blood pressures. And then again, the direct reflection of our perfusion status with our CO2. It's that breath by breath measurement that we can see.
And I also think a thing we learned by looking at some of our airway data was that ketamine doesn't always give you a bump, right? So just make sure you're optimizing your patient's blood pressure and not assuming that it's going to take you up and over. Most of these patients are acute injuries. Most of these patients haven't been laying around. Most of these patients still have a fight or flight in them, a catecholamine release, and ketamine probably will help you. But, you know, say somebody's been laying on the floor for 3 hours, it may not give you assistance in that. So just don't always assume it's going to bump it up. I think that's something we learned.
And just remember that your end title is going to be your predictor of something detrimental likely to occur way before your blood pressure or pulse ox will. So monitor that end title closely because it really is your window to your resuscitative status on that patient.
All right, so let's move into some trauma skills. First up, we have needle decompression. We've spoken a lot about this, about how the need not to go too deep, how to make sure that we are properly assessing this patient to make sure that they do have a true tension pneumothorax. Dr. Northheim and Bertrand just elaborated on all the bad things that can happen if you're not doing your appropriate assessment skills. But I do think when they're needed to be done, they do work really well.
They do, and I think that's why we went to the longer needle. You just got to be careful not to go too deep. But, you know, we kind of looked at a bunch of CAT scans back in the day when we had the 2-inch needles, and barely any of those were actually making it into the pleural cavity. Depending on, you know, the position, at the size of our patients and stuff like that, it's sometimes fairly difficult for those to get in. So that's one of the beauties of finger thoracostomy is you know you're in. Obviously, you're making a much bigger hole, and for some reason, if you're wrong about it, we have a problem. So that's why we only use it on trauma rest right now or with a med control call. Yes, I think needle decompression is a great skill, and I think that it is always best to go lateral on these now.
And it's such a rewarding procedure, right, when it's done correctly and when you do it for the right indications, because you have that patient who's hypotensive or severely hypoxic, and you do that needle decompression and you hear the rush of air and you see their vital signs immediately improve within the next 30 to 60 seconds. And you're like, yeah, we did it.
Especially if you hear the hiss.
Yes.
So one of the things I like to do, and should have mentioned this in the airway earlier, is I always carry a Sharpie on me. So if I have this patient that's kind of stable, but I think they're developing a tension, I'm starting to mark my sights. Like, yeah. It's easier for me to mark the sites then instead of scrambling and trying to identify where. Same way if I'm anticipating that I might have to do a surgical airway too. I think that's very important, setting yourself up for success, even in these trauma patients, these high-stress situations. And I think Dr. Bertrand touched on it earlier. Ultrasound, the new spear. Like, when it comes to needle decompression, we're just getting more and more tools to not only more adequately diagnose these people, but also to treat them better in the field with the equipment we have. We've already spoken a lot about warming techniques in general, some of the fluid warmers, blood warmers, heat packs. I think one of the things, too, that we kind of forget about is removing the patient from the environment and removing issues that could be causing the lower temperature. If they have wet clothes, just cutting them and leaving them laying on those wet clothes does not do us any benefit, right? And of course, you'll have a lot more advanced techniques once we get them to the hospital. We already discussed the brilliant idea of wrapping warming packs around IV tubing. Spinal immobilization, we touched on that earlier. We're not going to go over each and every single one of these. This is what is in best EMS protocol of must-have spinal immobilization. And then there's a whole nother list of err on the side of caution. And I like to put this in here just to illustrate that we can't rule anything out with these patients. And there's a whole nother list that we can't rule them out. So at the end of the day, if y'all are telling me a 65 or anybody that has a GCS less than 15, so somebody with Alzheimer's, if I don't put a C-collar on them, that's not on the agency, and that's not on y'all. That's on me, right? I just violated protocol. And I think sometimes we get a little lackadaisical with the C-collars. I know there's some debate out there, but we can't rule them out.
Right. And I think that back in the older days, we, you know, if you collared someone, you had to board them. You had to spider strap them. You had to head block them, right? So we made even more reasons up why we shouldn't collar the patient if they didn't need it. Now, it's pretty darn simple, and although these rigid collars are kind of, you know, pain in the butt, they are easier to store, but, you know, I think the more soft collars are probably more comfortable for patients, but we run out of room, they don't collapse, stuff like that. I think one of the most common things we do see is your demented patient, your Alzheimer's patient, anybody under GCS 15, you've got to be proactive with those patients, especially the older ones, because you cannot rule out C-spine injury in someone who is not alert nor in times four, even if that's their chronic state. So I think that's something we see a lot. And I think we're probably going to move even more into the over 65, probably making it more down the mandatory route, because I think we do, if we're going to do a head CT on a 65 or older, we're probably going to do a neck with it, because we do get surprised occasionally with, you know, C2 fractures, C3 fractures. So.
And if you have any question at all in your head about it, whether the patient's, you know, when we go to this protocol above 65 or they're 63, just think the potential for harm if you don't put it on compared to the potential harm you're doing by placing a cervical immobilization device. Okay, and we can clear easily in the ER if we feel like they don't need it. But just err on the side of putting one on. Because like I said earlier, it seems like a lot of C-spine fractures that we find, we were really not expecting. And they're kind of found incidentally.
And once these patients settle down, they a lot of them typically, and EMS gets frustrated with it, they say, oh yeah, I am having some pain. And the EMS is like, you told me you weren't having pain, right? So yeah. I think erring on the side of caution now that we don't have to board these people and tie them down is probably recommended.
It's an easy skill to do, right? You can put it on them while they're before they're extricated from the vehicle, mm-hmm. right? Just that extra layer of protection. Pelvic binders, I'm going to let you speak on this. We carry pelvic binders on all of our frontline ambulances now. So,
in my mind, it really doesn't hurt anybody. And we talked about before, you know, if your patient's hypotensive, you got to be thinking chest. Not a whole lot we can do belly-wise other than calcium TXA fluids and blood, get them to definitive care. Obviously, the pelvis can hold a ton of blood. It's not really recommended anymore to sit there and push on the pelvis to see if there's rock, which we used to always do because any blood that's coagulated is now probably going to start bleeding again. So, I mean, I just had a case the other day, a female. She was a little bit overweight, and she really didn't have an obvious deformity to her pelvis, but she was persistently hypotensive, really didn't have any other complaints. Trapped in the car for a while, gave her a unit of whole blood and shot a pelvic film, and she had an open book pelvic fracture. So, you know, I just think these patients, this doesn't really hurt a patient. A lot of these patients that are hypotensive are pretty sick. So I would say err on the caution of putting one on, especially if they're persistently hypotensive or you have a suspicion.
Yeah, and again, I really don't see the harm because when they get to us in the ER, that patient's going to go to the CT scanner pretty fast. And we're going to rule in or out a pelvic fracture within 30 minutes. So,
if you're worried enough about it, we're going to shoot just a pelvis by the bed, an X-ray, and rule it out. We can take it off, right?
Yeah.
So, it's not a bad idea to do it. I know there's some scales that TJ and I were talking about today, and you can certainly go through a grading system. But at the end of the day, I mean, if they're hypotensive and you're worried about it, you're just kind of taking one piece of the puzzle and eliminating it, and now you can focus on the rest.
It kind of goes along with the cervical collar, right? There's not a whole lot of harm that's going to come from this, but if we don't do it, we have the potential to cause patient harm by neglecting to treat the injury.
Just make sure it's not too high. Make sure it's over the greater trochanters is really the spot. We see a lot of them that are high riding, and that's really not doing a whole lot, you know, pushing on the iliac crest. It's got to be lower. We read an article today about kind of, you know, pushing more like an internal rotation of legs first and then doing it. There's obviously a simple sheet that you can use. There's the foil blankets you can use. Some people do, you know, when we used to have KEDs, upside down KED, but there's a couple commercial ones on the market that work terrific.
Yeah, I think one of the big things is this is not a skill you practice a whole bunch, right? And then you're put into that situation. So I think we need to do deliberate practice in making sure that we're putting these in the right place and not just putting a belt on somebody. Vacu splints, we actually started carrying these. I love these full body vacu splints. Anybody that's watching this that does rescue, I would never put anybody on a Stokes basket without one of these things. They are comfortable, malleable, so many things you can do. I'm not going to go into everything. I highly suggest if you don't have them, get them. They're amazing. But we use vacuum splints too, just for our normal bone fractures, right? Not much to those, you know, CMS pre and post.
Yeah, great device. Like you mentioned when we were talking previously, the SAM splints, you can put those in all kind of positions and still not get adequate stabilization, it seems. But these are really easy and get good stabilization and just don't leave them at the hospital because they're very expensive.
Yeah, these full bodies are great for elderly folks with hip fractures too. It kind of hugs them and really decreases their pain. I would say do not use the pelvic binder option on these because as soon as we open it at the hospital, all the hemostasis that you had and all the compression of the pelvis is going to go away. And then I also tell our crews to put a sheet down first. So that vacuum mattress should never really leave your cot. So you get to the ED, we're moving the patient over on the sheet with C-spine control. You're taking your vacuum mattress back. You're cleaning it up. Nobody's cutting through it. If you have a really sick patient, we do just a lot of just the newer scoops, the more fiberglass type stuff where, you know, collar, scoop them, get them on the cot, and let's go. You can set them up as well. But, you know, rescue-wise, or if you have time for it, if you have somebody that's having a lot of discomfort from, you know, proximal femur fracture and stuff like that, it's a great device to use. It just takes a little bit longer to get on.
We used it on a trauma patient that we had to transfer over to the helicopter, and it was amazing. We made everything so smooth. Don't endorse any specific brand, but I would highly suggest looking them up. Tourniquets. I think this is another skill along with the pelvic binders that we just assume we know how to do it. And in that situation, you don't want to be learning how to use a tourniquet. And I think what we see a lot of times is people that maybe aren't, you know, medical focused is improper placement. So would y'all like to go over why we need to go high and tight?
Yeah, I mean, we're just trying to get hemostasis. We definitely don't want to be on a joint. We definitely want to be up on the bigger part of the vessel. I think that knowing what device you carry, how to get it on, always having a second tourniquet in case you have to throw one, you know, a little bit higher than the one you have on is always a good thing as well. We see a lot of other folks, whether it's bystanders or our police partners, putting these on for just simple lacerations. So I think something we'll think about in the future is maybe an EMS takedown protocol too as well, because I think the one thing we don't think about is when you put tourniquets on and they come to the ED, especially trauma center, they're automatically going to be a level 2 trauma activation. So it brings a lot of resources and cost to the patient. And some of these that we take off have absolutely zero signs of arterial bleeding. It's a very superficial wound. So I think we may develop something like that in the future. But yes, tourniquets save lives. I think anybody can be taught to put one on. You want to make sure that you do not have a distal pulse when you get it on, and that's the point of it. But, I mean, you can keep these on. You want to time and date them. But, I mean, these can stay on for, you know, several hours safely. They use them in the OR all the time when they're doing surgeries and stuff, and patients do quite well. So,
patella reduction. This is more of a best EMS specific thing. I believe I've done one. And I always looked at it as, popping somebody's shoulder back in. Again, like that instant relief. I think it's another great tool that we have in our toolbox that makes our job a little bit easier. And it, I mean, frankly, it makes us look better if I can take somebody's pain away before I get to the hospital.
These are really painful. People don't want to move. They're very uncomfortable. So yes, I mean, if you can extend it and push it over with or without some, you know, a little bit of pain control first, these patients do a lot better. And when they get to the ED, we x-ray them, make sure they don't have a fracture, they get a knee immobilizer and crutches, and they go home for ortho follow-up. So if you guys do this, I mean, majority of the time that they spend in the ER has been greatly reduced.
Yeah, just, I got a phone call the other day, asked if they had reduced patella dislocation on a pediatric patient. They asked if they needed to go to a pediatric trauma center, and the answer is absolutely not, because these patients always go home. So this can be treated at any level 3 and above trauma center.
And then we're moving into traction splints. I've been doing this a long time, so they've actually gotten a lot more practical just by the size of them. I remember when I first started this, the thing was 4 or 5 foot long webbing, and I think there was a crank key on the end of the one that I learned on. But I think they're making a comeback just because of the practicality of it.
It's not a thing. I mean, it's comfort, right? It's comfort for the patient. I mean, if your patient's not an extremist or doing quite well, I mean, you can get away with position of comfort or vacuum splint and some pain medication. But, you know, if they're an extremist, having a ton of pain, putting some traction is great. Just be careful not to traction against a, you know, if you're also putting a pelvic binder on, that's probably not a good idea to put both. So obviously treat the pelvis first. But yeah, they're a lot smaller, a lot easier to use, but it's one of those skills that unless you, you know, lay somebody down and kind of practice it, when you're doing it real time, you know, on a road or in a ditch somewhere, it's you got to kind of practice it.
And then the very last thing to wrap this up, and I put this last because I assume it's something I hopefully never have to do, is the escharotomy. If I ever got to this point, I would probably open up the protocols to see where the lines are, and I'm probably freaking out. So you can explain why we would need to do the escharotomy.
Well, you would potentially need to do this in those patients who have circumferential burns to their torso or at least across the majority of the chest. And the problem is they get so tight that they just can't, you can't ventilate or oxygenate them because of how tight they are. So you need to, that would be the indication for this procedure. And the reason we put this in here is we had one case where someone doused themselves with gasoline and set themselves on fire. And they were really having trouble ventilating the patient. And then when Eric got there, they went ahead and proceeded with doing this procedure. So, yeah, it would be a good idea to look again
at the protocol book real quick to see where you have to do these incisions, and you want to use a tin blade, and you want to slice through until you get down to subcutaneous fat and run your finger along there to make sure you're getting that popping along and you're getting free release. And then you should see, hopefully, some improvement in your ability to oxygenate and ventilate.
This is one of those skills like a crike, right? If you don't do it, the patient may die, right? If you can't ventilate, it's going to be a problem. So it's one of those kind of that, yes, hopefully we don't ever have to do, but yes, I'd probably look at the diagram and cut down until you get some decent tissue and try to release it just long enough for them to ventilate.
Well, that's all. I think we hit most of the major trauma stuff. Of course, we're never going to be able to cover everything about trauma in here. I would like to thank y'all for joining us today on the YouTube/podcast. And is there anything else y'all'd like to add?
We'll see you next time. Thank you.
Yes, thank you.